What?
What?
Okay, I would like first to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving me the chance to describe my work here. This work is going on for maybe the last 4 years. It started by investigating, studying the properties of a relativistic, of entanglement of a relativistic free field. And then we went on to investigate only also discrete models which are associated with or have as a limit a relativistic field. So I would like to thank my collaborators, mainly Alon Robotero from Los Angeles University, two students from Tel Aviv, Alex Retzker and Jonathan Silman, and recently also Ignacio Sira. So to set up the general problem, we are thinking about a certain relativistic field or any a ground state of a relativistic field or another system which has a causal structure, and we are looking on two regions, A and B, in the vacuum. We know that even the vacuum, although there are no particles in the vacuum has zero particles, there are still non-zero fluctuations at regions A and B, and the question that we like to ask is whether A and B is entangled. Could be two separated regions or two complementary regions. How does this entanglement change as a function of the separation? What are the properties of this entanglement? And there are several motivations for looking at such problem. First of all, for me, it's a fundamental problem because you are dealing with field theory that, as we know, is a very fundamental, it's the fundamental way today, at least, of describing interaction between particles. And it deals with the link between special relativity and quantum mechanics. So the questions we ask could be what can we learn from quantum information about the relation between special relativity and quantum mechanics? From the point of view of quantum information, as we shall see, a relativistic field theory provides us with a very natural setup to study entanglement properties because it has a built-in causal structure. Therefore, it gives us a well-defined notion of what are local operations. Furthermore, we are dealing here with an infinite dimensional system. So we are dealing with a many-body system, and perhaps we will learn some new features about entanglement in such systems. From the point of view of quantum mechanics, one could hope that this could shed light, some new light on coherence effects. And we had some ideas along this line concerning low temperature, quantum phase transitions, the entropy area law, and the technique of DMRG in previous talks. So as a background, there are a set of results coming from continuum theory and set of results coming from discrete models. And the earliest results are coming from investigating the black hole or the area law of black hole entanglement entropy. And I should maybe note that in addition to the references given so far, there is actually a reference of Unruh, the seminal work of Unruh from 76, which is more concerned with black holes and the so-known Unruh effect of acceleration radiation, where he explicitly actually writes down without noting that this is entanglement, the wave function of empty space with respect to a bipartite partition and the explicit structure of a squeezed state appears already there. There are a set of results of Werners and collaborators using algebraic field theory methods. And more recently, we used a more explicit method using entanglement detectors in order to probe the entanglement in the setup of a vacuum field. There are results from discrete models. It could be harmonic chain models that we should discuss here, or spin chain models. Both of them have a limit where the correlations become sufficiently large, continuous theories. And we shall discuss also the possibility of realizing a detection of entanglement in a model of a linear ion trap, which is often used in connection to the Sirac-Zoller scheme for quantum computation. So the question which we should ask are as follows. We are given by the two regions, A and B. The field is in its vacuum state, ground state, and we are asking, are the regions A or B entangled? Are the degrees of freedoms of regions A or B entangled? And if they are, how does it change with the separation between the two regions? Are Bell inequalities violated? The state describing A and B is a mixed, it's a density matrix, so it's not obvious that the Bell inequalities can be violated. And finally, we should ask if there is entanglement, how is it associated with the structure, the special structure of the wave function, which is sitting in region A and region B, or where does entanglement come from? And finally, we should ask, can we actually realize an experiment in which we can detect the entanglement in region A and region B. So the answers I will suggest are yes, entanglement persists, and for arbitrary separation in two and arbitrary regions A and B, although it decays exponentially, and we should use the detector probe approach in order to see something like this. We should use the same approach also to see that the Bell inequalities are violated for an arbitrary separation, although it will require filtration, and therefore the Bell inequalities, the non-locality is of the hidden type, as suggested by Popesco and Nepal-Gisen. And going to investigate, to study the structure of entanglement, we should look on the harmonic chain, and we shall see that we'll find out that there are effects of localization of the inner modes or the entanglement, which might be interpreted or understood in terms of shielding of the entanglement within those regions, and this is suggested as a mechanism which allows the persistence of entanglement over long distances. And finally, we shall consider a process of detection of entanglement swapping in a linear ion chain, which is hopefully experimentally realizable. So the plan of the talk is first to look on field entanglement of a relativistic field using local probes. Then we shall move to a harmonic chain, a discrete version of a field theory, and study the structure, the spatial structure of entanglement. And finally, we shall look on the ion trap entanglement. So the key point or the key elements that we are going to use here are two basic properties of field theory of quantum information. A relativistic field theory has a built-in causal structure, that's the first element, while quantum information theory tells us that local operations do not change the amount of entanglement between two regions. This means the following: if we have our empty space and we add here two detectors or two localized systems, which initially do not interact with the vacuum, with the field, and we let those systems interact over a finite duration of time with the system, then atom A will generate a perturbation, but this perturbation will evolve only inside the light cone, the local light cone of the system, and therefore cannot affect atom B. Therefore, as long as we let the two atoms interact with the field over a duration Ct, which is smaller than the separation, the two systems are spatially disconnected, and therefore the idea of a local operation can be realized, i.e. the amount of entanglement, we expect the amount of entanglement within a certain area around the detectors to be non-changing. To spell this out a little bit more explicitly, so let's look at the two detectors. They are sitting all the time, they are situated in two causally disconnected regions. The black line denotes the duration in which the detectors couple with the field. The coupling is generating some radiation which is emanating from the detectors, but it cannot reach the other side. Because the two regions are causally separated, if we are looking on field operators at the two regions, it's clear from field theory that we are guaranteed that they commute to zero, which means that if we write down the unitary interaction between the detectors in the field, we are going to find out that it can be factorized into the product of two unitary operators, U which is acting only here and another U which is acting over here, which means that we have here a notion of local operation. The amount of entanglement does not change if we are keeping the two detectors causally disconnected. So this means that the total amount of entanglement is unchanging, but still we can swap, as we well know, we can swap entanglement from one system to another. In particular, we can have a situation where the two detectors end up in a state where the total amount of entanglement is non-zero. Since there is no exchange, no generation of entanglement through an exchange, it must be that in such cases we actually detect an entanglement which is already there in the vacuum. So this is an entanglement swapping. So what we have here is a simplifying situation where instead of looking on the vacuum, which is a complicated problem, we can investigate the final state of the two detectors. It's just a 4×4 density matrix, and we can obtain in principle a lower bound, only a lower bound on the amount of entanglement between two regions. So to set up the interaction between the detectors and the field, we can use ideas first suggested by Unruh or the Witt for a particle detector model. This was originally suggested as a method of showing the Unruh radiation, which is the case that the two detectors accelerate and they perceive the vacuum as full with particles, thermal radiation. In our case, the detectors are going to be stationary, so we assume that we have a pair of detectors with a rest mass which is sufficiently large so that we can localize them well within two causal disconnected regions. The detectors carry also internal levels, which for simplicity we take just a pair of internal levels, Now we couple between the internal levels and the field via this interaction, which is just a pairing between the raising and lowering operators, the internal levels, and the field at the location of the detector. Notice that we do not assume here the rotating wave approximation, which is usually taken in when treating interaction of atoms and field, because the duration of the interaction is going to be very, very short. So we cannot assume this approximation, which means that we can have, for example, processes in which we start with the detector in the ground state, we excite the detector and still emit a particle. These are off-shell, off-resonance processes. So we shall start with the state that we have a vacuum. We have two detectors which are decoupled from the vacuum. They are separable. There is no entanglement between the two detectors. They are in the ground state. And now the idea would be to calculate the time evolution of the system, take the trace over the field, degrees of freedom, and end up with a 4 times 4 density matrix, final density matrix for the two atoms. We should do this by using a perturbative approach, and then the question would be, is the final state separable or not? And this we can check easily for such a system by using the partial transposition idea of Peres, or we can quantify the amount of entanglement either by using the negativity or the entanglement of formation as a measure. So just to sketch how the calculation goes, we start with the interaction, the total interaction. This is in the interaction picture. We expand in powers of epsilon of the interaction up to the lowest order, which will give us a low and non-trivial effect. This turns out to be the second law order. We apply the unitary on the state. We take the trace over the field degrees of freedom, and what we get is this relatively simple density matrix of the two atoms. So it's block diagonal, and there are two types of terms which we can identify here. The off-diagonal term over here, the XAB, corresponds to the wave function of the field, which is obtained by applying two field operators, meaning that we either emit two photons, or one detector emits a photon, and the second one absorbs the photon. So the overlap between the vacuum and this amplitude corresponds to the process which is diagrammatically described here, sort of a finite diagram, in which you start with the two detectors in the down. One detector emits a photon, goes to the up state. The second detector absorbs the photon, goes to the up state as well. This is a virtual process. And one would expect that this would correspond to generation of entanglement. Yes?
Why is the matrix not symmetric under particle interchange?
It's not symmetric under?
Particle interchange.
Particle interchange. It is symmetric.
It's a symmetric matrix, but if you do a particle swap,
You mean the A and B?
No, I mean the center two columns and rows. If you swap them, you don't get the same matrix. Two columns and rows.
So again?
The center two columns and rows. Two things are not necessarily equal, for example.
So I'm not sure I understand you. I mean, this is what
the
we have here.
The two particles A and B are not symmetrically related. One is different from the other. I want to know what you did that makes them different.
Well, we start with a definite initial condition. The initial condition is a down-down state.
Yes, that was symmetric in the particles. This is not.
Oh, I'm sorry. This should be the. You mean here?
I mean the whole matrix. I'm not looking at one element of the matrix.
Yes. So if you interchange A and B, this simply goes to here and this simply goes to here. I'm sorry. Maybe I should continue and later you can ask me the question again.
All right.
Okay. So these two elements correspond to an exchange of a virtual photon. So the off diagonal elements correspond to an exchange of a virtual photon. The diagonal elements, for example, these elements over here are obtained by applying the field operator on the vacuum, so we get one photon emitted and they correspond to these two diagrams over here. And now we can ask what happens if we take a partial transpose. If you take a partial transpose, this flips between these off-diagonal elements, between these two off-diagonal elements, and it's now clear what will happen. There will be a competition between these two terms and these two terms on the diagonal. And if we check what's the condition for finding a negative eigenvalue, it turns out that we get the condition that the exchange process must be larger than the product of the local emissions. So this is a very simple intuition below it. It means that we have an exchange process which is responsible for generating entanglement. So if you would start with something like this, we would have just this diagram over here, you would have an extra element which goes like down, down, plus up, up now, which corresponds to entanglement. But this is not the only thing that we have here. We have also emission processes which tend to decohere the system. So if this diagram has a larger effect than the product of these diagrams, the final state corresponds to a density matrix which is entangled. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. So can you go back to the previous slide?
Yes.
So what you did is a partial transpose right. With relation to the second, but you can as well take a partial transpose with relation to the first part.
Right.
But then the density matrix doesn't change. And so I don't understand why this can...
No, I think it doesn't matter. I mean, we can...
Yes, but then it's just you have to take the blocks and always... Yeah. That
well, this is the down-down. This is the down-down element, and this is maybe the thing that which is confusing is that I didn't write it in the standard basis. This is the down-down element. This is the up-up element.
Yeah.
I apologize for it. In the new version of the paper, it appears there. This is the old matrix. Okay. So we are getting a condition which is very intuitive, very simple, and we can explicitly write this as an integral inequality. We have an inequality between those two sides. This is the emission, this is the exchange. And now the question is, can we satisfy it? So the question is, can we choose epsilons? I didn't mention epsilon is the window function, is the one which determines how long does the interaction open in time. And epsilon tilde is the Fourier transform of the window function. And since we started with the two detectors in the down condition, we see that in the emission we have here the square of the off-resonance process. So it goes like the square of an off-resonance process. Omega is the energy gap and little omega is the frequency of the vacuum. On the other hand, in the right-hand side, we have here an off-resonance process times a resonance process, meaning one of them emits, this would be an off-resonance process, the other one can absorb it, but then it will be a sort of an on-resonance process. So there is a hope that we can satisfy it because this dies off much stronger as we take the capital omega to be large, to be more and more off-resonance. However, we have another problem, which is that the right-hand side depends on the separation. So as we take the separation to be larger, this oscillates faster. Is a function of omega, and this tends to smear out the right-hand side. So we have to choose cleverly or go sufficiently off-resonance with omega in order to satisfy this inequality. And this turns out to be the best choice we were able to set up is to use functions which are known as super-oscillatory functions, which were, I think, found first by Aronov and later developed by Michael Berry. These functions have the property that the window functions, although it naturally oscillates fairly slow because it has a finite support in time. In a finite region of omega, it can oscillate very fast, faster than any Fourier component of the field, of the function. So if you choose these functions, it turns out that we can show analytically that for every separation, we can tailor this window function, our opening and closing window function, in such a way that it will resonate with the sign omega L a vacuum window function. So these are the oscillations match, so they build up over a finite regime, and it turns out that we nevertheless pay a penalty for this behavior, which is that the exchange term has to decay exponentially, does decay exponentially with the distance. I will discuss it a little bit later. So what we can show here is that we get a lower bound on the amount of entanglement, which is an exponential decay with the distance. T is the duration of the opening, L is the distance, so T quantifies the size of the region, L the separation. What about Bell inequalities? Are they violated? Well, they are not violated because the amount of entanglement is very small. This amplitude over here can be exponentially small as a function of the distance. So naturally, if we calculate the CHSH inequality, it is not violated. Nevertheless, we know that we can probe for hidden type of non-locality. So what we want to do is we want to minimize, we want to equilibrate between the two terms by filtering out mainly these terms and filtering out these terms and keeping this term to equilibrate between the two terms. So we choose this filtering parameter. We make a filtering at each side of the detectors. We choose a subset. And for this subset of events, we can show that while the negativity without the filtering dies off as a function of the distance, as a function of the energy gap very strongly, as a function, if we do this filtering, we can get a situation where the amount of entanglement tends to a pure EPR pair. And not surprisingly, if we apply now the if and only if condition devised by the Rudeckis for this case, the operator M, which shows an entanglement for M larger than 1, we find that we, in this situation, we can have a maximal violation if we go to sufficiently high omega S.
Would actually implementing this filtering physically require classical communication between the two sites?
After performing the measurement, of course.
Yeah,
you'll have to, sure. As is usually the case. So in this sense, we can show that we have a violation of Bell inequalities for arbitrary separation from arbitrary regions in space. So to sum up the first approach, we claim that we can, in principle at least, as a Gedanken experiment, show that we can extract the entanglement of the vacuum into a physical system and later use it if you want. We obtained the lower bound. The best lower bound we got by using the detector approach goes like e to the minus L squared divided by T squared. However, possibly we can have a tighter bound by looking at the harmonic oscillator case, which I shall present in a moment. We also know that although the separation is very large and you could anticipate that entanglement is associated with low frequency effect, it's actually associated here at least with higher frequency effect because you need to choose the energy gap of the detectors to be very large as we go with higher separation. Again, we would like to connect it to the next approach. And finally, we show that Bell inequalities can be violated for an arbitrary separation, at least in the sense of hidden non-locality, and in this case, we can have a maximal violation. Yes?
So the photon that you showed exchanging between A and B, it's got to be a virtual photon.
It's a virtual photon, yes.
Can you sort of get the same sort of, the exponential there, it sort of looks like...
No. That's an interesting thing. You get the exponential behavior only because you put in these window functions. It's a property of the window functions. If you just calculate a expectation correlations between distances, it falls off not exponentially, but as a power law. So the surprise in some sense is that while you have a power law decay in field theory, entanglement drops off exponentially here. And I will try to explain why we expect this to be the case indeed, from another point of view. So now we want to get some better grasp on the structure. This doesn't tell us much about the structure of entanglement in this theory. And in order to do something like this, we were going and looking on a discretized model of a field, which is equivalent to looking on a harmonic chain, on a linear harmonic chain, with nearest neighbor coupling. So we know that if we have in a one-dimensional setup, the previous setup was not restricted, by the way, with dimensionality. It's true for any dimension. The changes are very, very small from... The basic behavior is the same in any dimension. Here we look on a circular setup, so we have a field in a compact region, and we can probe this field, sample this field over a discrete set of points. And if we do this, then a scalar field theory, a Klein-Gordon field theory, maps into a harmonic chain which nearest neighbors coupling. And in the limit that the coupling becomes strong and the number of oscillators becomes large, we can map this chain back to the scalar field. So the advantage of looking of this setup is that, as was mentioned in Martin's talk, we have here a ground state, which is a Gaussian ground state, and many of the things can be calculated exactly. The entanglement can be calculated exactly. And we can do another step and look not only on the amount of entanglement, but also where does it arise. And we should do this by employing the mode-wise decomposition theorem, which I will describe. And by this, we will be able to identify the spatial structure of entanglement. So just to outline the calculation here again, it was already described here. Usually, you start with a wave function. You calculate the reduced density matrix. You get the eigenvalues. and then you get the entropy. This is not what we do here. Instead, we start with the second moments, the correlations, and they are sufficient in order to obtain from here the covariance matrix, which is a finite matrix, and this completely describes the reduced density matrix in a certain region. So from here, we can calculate the symplectic spectrum, and from here, immediately, we get the total amount entanglement entropy by summing up an expression, which is slightly similar to the von Neumann expression, but different, summing over all the values of lambda i. Doing this, we get the following result. So suppose we have a set, we have the circular chain, we look on a subset of oscillators, of NB oscillators, a block of oscillators, and we're asking what's the amount of entanglement between this block and the rest of the chain as a function of the size of the block, goes like this, and the strength of the coupling between the nearest neighbor. So in this direction, we have strong coupling, this would tend to the continuum limit. If you're looking in the weak coupling regime, we see that the entanglement grows and very quickly saturates. It doesn't go much farther as we are looking at the weak limit, it saturates. And this is due to the fact that the correlation length becomes of the order of the size of the block. So no longer we can get a collective effect inside the block. If you're looking, on the other hand, at the extreme regime that the coupling is strong and the correlation is much larger than the size of the block, then we get here a behavior which is logarithmic, which is proportional to the ln of NB. This is plotted, this regime over here is plotted over here. We get that E is proportional to ln of NB with the coefficient which was mentioned, 1/3, which corresponds to a conformal bosonic field theory with C equals 1. We got it both numerically and analytically, but I will not have time to describe here the analytic results. And again, if you go sufficiently far, you start getting the saturation effect of entanglement. So now we want to say something more. We want to split up the entanglement into the contributions of entanglement for from different regions. And to do this, we are using the following theorem, which we call the mode-wise decomposition theorem. So the claim is the following. Suppose you are given by a certain set of oscillators. These are oscillators, and the coupling is a usual harmonic coupling, but you can have coupling between any pair of oscillators. Doesn't matter what's the nature of the interaction, as long as it's quadratic, and the wave function is Gaussian. If you choose a bipartite splitting, can be any splitting between two groups of oscillators, for any splitting, you can perform a unitary transformation on this side and a unitary transformation on the other side in such a way that you define new collective coordinates, capital Q and P, which are functions of the old ones, the local ones, Q and P, in such a way that in the new coordinates, the entanglement is just between two modes, only between two modes, between one side to another side. So in this sense, Gaussian entanglement is very simple. There is nothing more for the bipartite case than 1 times 1 mode-wise entanglement on only squeezed states. So mathematically, if you start with the Schmidt decomposition, which you can always have, you can perform a local view and map it to this form where you have a product of bipartite squeeze states. Each one of these guys is just a squeeze state. And if you have an extra number, a higher number in another side, or for example in the area theorem, you could some of the oscillators can remain in their ground state as uncoupled. So if we now calculate the entanglement of the system, it will simply be the contribution of this pair plus this pair plus the contribution of this pair and so on. We can break entanglement into the contribution of each of those EPR-like pairs according to their entanglement contribution. We want to say a little bit more. We want to say also for each one of those pairs, where does entanglement come from? What's the structure of each one of those pairs? So what we do is the following. Suppose we start with our initial Qs and P. We perform this transformation which does this diagonalization into the mode-wise form. And we find the relation between the local P's and the collective P's. This relation involves some functions, U and V, which tell us the distribution, how much the local oscillator contributes to the collective mode. It turns out that if we multiply these two functions, we get a very nice function with nice properties, which quantifies the participation of the local oscillator to the collective mode. It has the property that the sum of these guys is 1, it's normalized. If it's a wave function, it's positive, although we have never proved that it's actually positive all the time. And what we are going to see now, we are going to plot the function P for any of these pairs, all those pairs. So this is the participation function. We have this, so we have here four plots. Each plot corresponds to a different value of the coupling between the oscillators. So let's look at the plot up here. So we have here a change of 80 oscillators. We have a block of 32 oscillators and another block of 48 oscillators over here. The axis which goes there in this direction corresponds to each one of those pairs. So if you look at a line here, this corresponds to a participation function of a single EPR pair, squeeze state. If you go over here, we have another contribution of another EPR squeeze state. And the contribution is ordered in such a way that the lines which are closer to you have the highest entanglement and a decreasing order in this direction. So these lines have the lowest amount of entanglement. And the total amount is, as I said, the total contribution of the sum of the partial entanglements. So what we see is that in the weak coupling regime, the correlation is very short. So it turns out essentially two oscillators here, which are sitting on the edge, are coupled with two oscillators in the other block. As we go to lower contribution of entanglement, we have two oscillators over here, which are coupled to two oscillators over here, and so on. So it's essentially an effect of two oscillators at each side, which are coupled to two oscillators at the other side, more or less local. If we increase the coupling, what happens is that the correlation length increases, so we get more and more collective type of effects. In the strong coupling regime, we see that we have a whole region for each one of those mode-wise decomposition wave functions. Well, a whole region of oscillators here couples to a whole region of oscillators here, but notice that always we have localization of the innermost modes. I mean, here we have always a region where the contribution is always zero. So here's another view of the mode shapes that we got, maybe a slightly clearer view. We are looking just on one block. This is the weak coupling case. We have the pair of contributions outside. As we go more and more inside, we have less and less entanglement, and the modes are becoming closer and closer until we get a single region over here. Here it's more collective, and notice something interesting. This should correspond to the continuum regime. Notice something interesting, that as we are going, the first contribution comes from the collective mode. All the oscillators are sort of spinning together. But as we go inner and inner, the frequency here becomes higher and higher, and the regions become more and more localized. And there is always a point of truncation where the wave function or the contribution becomes zero. We have an effect of a localization. One can also ask for each one of those mode-wise contributions as a function of the number. How does it contribute to the entanglement? Then what we see here is that as a function of the mode number, we have an exponential decay of entanglement. So this is an exponential a logarithmic plot, and we have a straight line, meaning for a slight deviation for the strong coupling regime, but generally the decay is a function of the depth of the mode is exponential, which is again the same property that we found from the detector probes. So this suggests a certain picture of what's going on. This is only part of the details that are in the paper. First of all, we recovered, as expected, the continuum result with the one-third factor, and we have some understanding of it which I cannot explain here. And the new feature which we find compared to these calculations, which usually do not deal with the structure of entanglement, only with the total amount of entanglement, is that we have here the situation that the inclusion of an ultraviolet cutoff necessarily gives rise to a localization of the innermost modes. So this suggests that the effect of persistence of entanglement over a finite duration, over a long duration, is somehow related to the fact that inside the regions we can have modes which are very well isolated or shielded from environmental effects, while we pay the penalty that we have a contribution to the entanglement which drops off exponentially. While the external modes are coupled very strongly to the environment, and therefore they do not give rise to entanglement contribution between the two regions. Okay, so so I would like to move to the last part of the talk, in which I would like to ask the question, can we actually detect something like this? And here I refer to the first method of extracting entanglement from the vacuum. Can we really perform such an experiment of detecting, say, from the electromagnetic field vacuum entanglement between two regions. Well, it seems highly unrealistic, at least for the case of the electromagnetic case, because we need a very fine control on the window functions, and we need a very fine control to prepare the separable detector states, non-entangled states, and finally we need to detect the entanglement with very high accuracy. So in the realistic case of electromagnetic fields, at least at now it seems non-realistic to do such an experiment. Nevertheless, we know that in other systems, when we think about the vacuum in the more general notion of the ground state of a certain system, for example, in atomic physics, we know that in certain systems, like in the ion trap, we can well control the interaction. We have excellent control on the interaction between the motional states of the ions and the internal states of the ions by means of laser pulses. The internal states of the ions are well isolated, so we can well prepare an initial state which is completely unentangled with the motional states, and we essentially can measure the final state of the atom with accuracy which is nearly perfect, less than 1% in current experiments. So we were looking on the situation of a chain in an ion trap, a linear chain in an ion trap, trying to realize the idea, the effect of extracting entanglement, i.e. in this case it could be measuring, detecting the entanglement between motional degrees of freedom of massive ions. So the situation is as follows. We have a line, an array, a line of ions, of massive ions, which are arranged in equilibrium state and they are cooled to their ground state. What corresponds to the vacuum in this case would be the ground state of the motional states of the ions. So there are no phonons. In other words, there are no phonons in the system. And what we would like to do is to measure the entanglement between a pair of ions, between the spatial degrees of freedom of a pair of ions or groups of ions. And the question is, can we realize the idea of utilizing the causal structure, as we did in the first method, in order to do something like this? So the idea would be, I will show you that we do have essentially a causal structure, although it's not an exact causal structure like in field theory, it's an approximate causal structure, and we can have a situation which, when we perturb a certain ion over here, it takes certainly some time until the perturbation reaches the second ion over there. So if we do this perturbation for a short enough time, we are assured that atom A and atom B do not get entangled by this perturbation. So the basic idea would be to send appropriate laser pulses, which have a finite duration of time, as in the first approach, in such a way that the motional degrees of freedom are coupled to the internal degrees of freedom, and entanglement by this process is swapped into the internal degrees of freedom without communicating between the two atoms, and finally detected after the interaction is closed off. So what we have here is a situation that we need to choose T, which is much smaller than the typical 1/3 frequency timescale of propagation between the two ions. This timescale, this frequency here, is actually the lowest frequency of a vibration of the collective mode of the system, which implies that if we look in the Hamiltonian, it's not the usual Hamiltonian which employs the rotating wave approximation as in the Sirac-Zola scheme, but on the other hand, we couple here directly to X, not to A plus A, which acts on this, and AW on this, but to X, meaning again, we can have virtual processes in this case as well. So this is the free Hamiltonian. We have the two internal levels. This corresponds to the free Hamiltonians of the phonons, and the coupling is again very similar to what we had before, where X, the location with respect to equilibrium, plays the role of the field at the location of the detector. So now, before we do this, we can investigate what's the entanglement properties of this system. How does it behave? So if we take a chain of N ions, we can ask how much entanglement we have between two halves of the chain, how much entanglement we have between two groups of inside the chain, and so on. If we had just two ions, in the simplest case, then the vacuum would be just the ground state of the collective mode, both of them moving together, times the ground state of the breathing mode, they're moving in opposite directions, But we can again use, because this is a Gaussian state, we can again write this wave function in terms of local occupation numbers, n of each one of the oscillators, and again it has the same structure of a two modes free state. So if you can write it down in this form, we can quantify the amount of entanglement in terms of the beta which is sitting here. And we can do the same thing if we have a long chain, again by the mode-wise decomposition theorem, the full state factors out into a product of the squeeze states. So this is what we see here. On the left, we have the total amount of entanglement between two halves of the chain as a function of the total size of the chain. And we see that it grows very, very slowly. For just two ions, the amount of entanglement can be computed analytically, and it's below 0.2 e-bits of entanglement, and then it grows very slowly until it comes closer to one, but for a very, very long chain. This is due to the fact that the coupling between the ions is essentially weak, rather than strong as in the field theory case. So we don't have a control on the coupling as in the field case. It's dictated by the frequency of the confining potential, confining field. We can do something similar for two groups of ions. So we choose two groups of ions and check whether the negativity is zero or non-zero, or how does it decay as a function of the separation. And we see something like this. For just for just two ions, as a function of the separation, it dies off to zero. It truncates after a separation of two or more. For a group of, say, five ions, it dies off much slower. You can take it up to a separation which is about five. In the continuum case, you can, of course, take it to much higher, longer separations. So we can check whether we can probe either entanglement between single ions or groups of ions by doing this coupling. Now we can, in order to realize this approach, we also need a causal structure, because we have to keep the two ions causally disconnected. So we checked whether we have a well-defined causal structure. So if we have a chain of 80 ions, and we disturb the ion in the center, this is a classical description of how the disturbance propagates as a function of time. So we take the central ion and we shake it a little bit, and we let the propagation go as a function of time, spread, and what we see here is very well that the disturbance is very well localized within a light cone, an effective light cone with respect to the phonon velocity here. And however, it's not an exact behavior. You have here tails which decay very fast outside this light cone, and we shall see in a moment that in some sense it has an advantage, because we can use these tails to test some interesting things. We can do the same thing also for the commutation, because what we want is actually the total unitary factors out into a product of two unitaries. So what we can do is to calculate the commutation between the position of the ion in the center and the position of the ion at some later time along the chain. So we see that outside the light cone, it always nearly vanishes, as we expect, like the commutation of the two field operators vanish outside the light cone, and it doesn't vanish very well in agreement to the classical picture inside the light cone alone. So this means that up to a very good approximation, we can take our unitary operator, the interaction, which represents the interaction, and factor it out into two local unitaries. So we do have the notion of local operations up to a correction which depends on t. And if we take t to be sufficiently small compared to the relevant time scale, which is 1/ the typical frequency of the phonons, we are assured that this correction can be small as we like. So we believe that a proof of principle of this detection effect can be done, at least for the case of two ions. So we have a ground set of two ions that we don't have the full causal structure as we have with a long chain. But for two ions still, if we take the limit that the interaction takes place over a duration which is much, much shorter than the typical interaction time, we can go to an arbitrary short duration in principle, we can demonstrate this effect. And the idea is the following. We start with the ground state of the vacuum and the ground state of the two internal levels. We want to generate an interaction which essentially swaps. It's not a swap in a normal situation, it's a normal swap, but it essentially takes the two first terms of the vacuum and sweeps it into the internal state of the two ions, and it changes the state of the vacuum into another state. So the way that we do it is essentially by sending a series of pulses which couple between x and sigma x, and effectively we can generate also coupling between p and sigma y, And it turns out that by a series of such three pulses that we have over here, by optimizing over alpha and beta, choosing a proper set of alpha and beta, and calculating the final amount of entanglement of formation in the final state of the two ions, we can account up to 97% of the exact of the calculated entanglement in theory between the two ions. So to a very high accuracy, we can actually extract everything, and the final state of the two ions is very good approximation, just a pure state which corresponds to the vacuum state. That's the histogram which describes the final state of the two ions. And again, since the limitation of measuring these things is less than 1%, it's well inside the possibility of realizing something like this. Finally, the final thing would be to ask whether we can do something for a long chain to realize the idea that you can open the interaction over a finite duration of time, let the perturbation go, but still not reach B, and probe the entanglement between larger groups of ions. Certainly, if we just open it for a very fine, short duration of time, then ion A and B are non-entangled, because these are just single ions, and we saw that the entanglement truncates after a separation of one. So we have to probe somehow a larger region of entanglement between the two regions. We have to probe larger blocks of ions. And what we did here is to repeat again the calculation by using simple, not a specially designed window function, and calculating perturbatively the final state of the two ions. But now you start to worry. If you open it over a finite duration of time, how do we know that actually it's not the non-local effect, meaning the effect that propagates in the velocity of light, which is the one that generates entanglement between here and here? How can we make sure that actually we are probing vacuum entanglement and not a very tiny effect which corresponds to a fast propagation faster than the phonon velocity? So the idea we used is the following. We compared two situations. One situation, we start with the ground state and evolve it as usual. The second situation is that we took the chain and truncated it, simply put to zero the interaction between the two ions in the center. So this completely separates the two regions, and it takes the Hamiltonian into a block diagonal Hamiltonian, where you completely isolate the two regions. Surely this type of Hamiltonian cannot increase the amount of entanglement, because we simply cut the two regions into two. So we compare the two situations. And what we find is something like this. So this is the case where we take the two ions at the location 6 and 15, and the length of the chain is 20, so they are fairly far apart. Then if the duration of time of the interaction is very short, we get zero entanglement, we start to increase the duration of the interaction. At some point, we get, for a certain detuning of the laser, we get a region, we always get a region where we do have entanglement, and the black line corresponds to the non-truncated model. We have a tiny amount of entanglement. It's the nearly less. And the red line corresponds to the truncated model. So we get for both entanglement, but surprisingly what we see here, it surprised us initially, is that we get more entanglement for the truncated case. This is a little bit strange, because you would expect that in the non-truncated case, you would get a tail that goes through causally to the second ion and will increase a little bit the entanglement rather than decreasing it. So why do we get actually more entanglement in this case? So to get a handle of this, we looked also in the case where the two ions are just nearest neighbors. Surely we have entanglement between nearest neighbors. And in this case, you can go with the time arbitrarily short, and you still get entanglement, always. So in this case, what happens is that the two lines which corresponds to the truncated and non-truncated match perfectly as you take the duration of time to be as small as we can, smaller and smaller. Meaning it doesn't matter if we truncate or not truncate the system. But that's natural. The entanglement is already there, so the evolution has no role. So the way that we understand it in this case is the following. If we return to this picture, why does truncation introduce more entanglement? If we return to this picture, there is no entanglement between here and here. There can be entanglement between these ions, for example, and these ions, because they are closer. So in order to probe this entanglement, we have to generate a perturbation which propagates, interacts with these guys, and goes back. We have to send something, probe it remotely by the interaction, by the fact that we have a non-zero interaction, and then get the entanglement. But if we put here a wall, this is the effect of truncation, then surely what will happen is that the effect of reflection backwards is going to be much, much stronger than the case when there is no wall and there are no reflections, some of the things go to the other side and we miss part of the information. So this, I think, suggests why an explanation to this case, and this, in some sense, it tells us that we can, by having partial causality, not exact causality, we can actually learn something on what's going on in the system. So to summarize, use three approaches: use the atom probes in order to show that entanglement, vacuum entanglement, can be swapped to detectors, and to show that violation, at least hidden violation, can be shown in the vacuum. We found that entanglement decays exponentially with the separation, and it's a UV effect, it's a high frequency effect rather than a low frequency effect, and we found very strong evidence to these points by looking on the discrete model. And in the discrete model, we also found that we have a new effect of localization of the inner modes, which again explains the mechanism how does entanglement persist over long distances. And finally, we hope that detection of entanglement in an ion trap is experimentally feasible. And here, I should note that this is also interesting from the point of view of quantum information, because essentially what we do here is we generate entanglement without doing the Dirac-Zoller gates. Thank you.
Well, I know people have questions, but because we are running late, maybe we should leave questions for a coffee time. Let's pan the speaker again, and let's introduce the next speaker. Next speaker is Professor Olavo, and he's going to talk to us about additivity problems.